Hana Esther.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We're waiting for somebody else.
No problem.
Daniel.
Good evening, Daniel.
Good evening.
Do you have any questions?
I do have questions.
Well, that's what this is all about.
Are we waiting for others?
There is one, somebody else on already, so we can start. Let me do a L'Shem Yichud. L'Shem Yichud, Kutshaber Yichu Ishkin David Hilu or Himu Ud Hilu. Ud Hilu or Himu. Le'akta Hashem Yud He Bavavhe. The Yichudah Shalim B'Shem Kol Yisrael. Limud Torah Mitzvah. La'asok Torah Mitzvah. Vayehino am Adonai Eloheinu aleinu ma'aseh yadeinu kananeh aleinu ma'aseh yadeinu kananehu. So what is your question, Daniel?
Well, I had two questions. After hearing the classes on the luminous emanations from Rabbi Oshlag.
Okay.
And the first question that I had was wondering about divakut. And is that the same or similar to the word tidbaku that we say daily when we use the word cleave?
No. Divakut is cleaving to God rather than pleading with God. Divakut is what happens when you're in a frame of meditation, where literally you unify with God. That's on one level. On another level, divakut means to act in the physical world with the attributes of God. So God is merciful, so if you're showing mercy to another person, then you are cleaving to God. If you're patient with someone, that's an attribute of God, so you cleave to that aspect of God. That's what the meaning of divakut is. When you cleave to God, you're praying. Praying is a specialized form of action. Whereas divakut is also a specialized form of action, but in a different frame of reference. Is it clear, or do I need to go on?
It sounds like something I'll have to experience.
It is something that you need to experience. But you've experienced it already in your life. You've done a good deed for somebody, right?
Sure.
When you've done that good deed, you have cleaved to God by acting in the way, in the specific attribute that you're doing. You cleave to God, except it's not something that you would feel in that sense.
So are we just playing out the movie when that happens, or is that actually binding by striking?
It depends on your consciousness. It depends on the situation, wouldn't it? The movie plays out. If you're supposed to do that action and you're doing it as a reaction to the request, somebody comes to you and asks if you can help them, can they borrow your lawnmower, as an example. If you're reacting to that by saying yes, then it's the movie playing out. But if you're stopping that reaction because your reaction was to say no, and then you're stopping your reaction and you're going through the steps, and you decide, yes, the pro action is to give him the lawnmower, You are cleaving to God. You'd experienced that. You just didn't feel it.
What about when Isaac allowed himself to be bound as a sacrifice?
That was his tikkun. How old was Isaac when he was bound?
He was an adult.
Correct. He was 37 years old. If someone comes to kill you as an adult, are you supposed to allow him to kill you?
No.
You're supposed to defend yourself. So why would Isaac allow himself to be bound as a... Some people say it was because he was honoring Abraham, his father.
Right, but that also honors Hashem, right? If you're honoring your father, you're also honoring Hashem.
Correct. But again, that depends on what Isaac's consciousness was. We don't know it per se. He could have been honoring his father, but I prefer to perceive him as honoring Hashem, because that was his tikkun. His tikkun as a chariot for Gevurah is to allow the attribute of Chesed to bind him so that he follows Chesed. He gives his power to Chesed. Now, these are adjectives, these are words that as you understand more of the Sefirot, Gevurah has the power. Strength. Does love have strength?
Of course.
Does it?
Well, it endures. It certainly has endurance.
It has endurance, but does it have power? Does it have strength? It's not the same kind of power that we would think of in the sense of physical power, is it?
No.
It is said that if we didn't have Gevurah, if we didn't have that power, there would never be a child brought into the world. Because the relationship of male and female, they're two different species, so to speak. There's no affinity between a man and a woman, except through the power of Gevurah. When Isaac allowed himself to be bound, he was giving his power to the attribute of Chesed, to the attribute of loving kindness. He was allowing himself to be controlled by love, which is not his nature. It was going against his nature, which is essentially the essence of binding by striking, as we taught and discussed a number of times. Is it clear?
I think so.
Good. What was the second question?
Yeah, 1 second. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. About the Ayin Sof. In the Ayin Sof, there wasn't any lack or desire, but we had bread of shame. Is that similar to the Sheni Zerah?
Well, that's when I'm not understanding your pronunciation. Is it similar to what?
Is it Shinui Zerah?
Spell it for me.
Shinui Tzura.
Shinui Tzura?
Yes, thank you.
First off, let's understand some things that you said about the Ein Sof that isn't quite accurate. there is desire in the Ein Sof. But before the vessel felt the desire, it was fulfilled by the light. That's the essence of the unity of light and vessel. Now, in our world, when the light fulfills the desire, there's a short circuit, unless there's binding by striking to push it back. Now, in the Ein Sof, there was no binding by striking, and yet there was no self short circuit. So we don't really understand that. It just is. We accept it. Now, I honestly don't remember what was the definition of Shinui Tura. You remember what I said in the, what Rabbi Akhlag described it as?
I've got it printed out here. Let me find it one moment.
I'm supposed to have all of the code words memorized, but it's been a while since I've been studying the essay that he wrote.
So the paragraph that brought it to mind after I read this, this is when I had the question. On the other hand, it is possible to deepen and increase the vessel of reception indefinitely and eternally. That is because now the form of reception does not produce any shinui zarah as it comes from within the will to bestow.
Shinui Bitsura is that of shame in Aramaic.
Oh.
So let's go back to what you said about the Ein Sof. There is desire, there is the fulfillment of that desire. And in essence, when we did not earn that fulfillment, we developed a false illusionary consciousness called bread of shame. The reason it's called bread is because the more you eat, the more shame you feel, the worse you feel. If you ate nothing but existence, you have less bread of shame. Now, in this world, the only way to remove bread of shame, which is that the consciousness that I haven't earned it, the only way you remove that is through binding by striking. And as you remove bread of shame, the capacity of your vessel strengthens and expands. And that can be indefinitely, because you could be the endless vessel all by yourself. And when I say that you could be the endless vessel all by yourself, I'm really saying that every human being has the capacity for to reveal the light that it was created to reveal. But the vessel has bread of shame, so it can't reveal all that light. The vessel has dirt and crap that we have accumulated over lifetimes that takes up the space within the capacity, and so therefore the light cannot be revealed. So as we cleanse ourselves, the capacity of the vessel expands relative to what it was before. Can the vessel become absolutely larger than it was created to reveal? The answer is no, but we're nowhere near that. That's why we speak in terms of the scientists speak in terms of you're using your 3, 4, 5% of your brain capacity. That's that's how much more we have capable of revealing the light of the of Hashem, the light of fulfillment. But we don't have the desire for it, do we?
That's why we have the five worlds. Is that that's what the Olamot is?
No, the worlds is a process of transforming the infinite light of God to a level called the finite light of God. It's easier if we put it in terms of humanity. Alexander the Great had a desire to conquer the world. Correct?
Correct.
You know anybody in this generation that has a desire to conquer the world?
No, there was that one famous song about it, but no, not really.
Even Donald Trump, he had a capacity to make, or a desire to make more and greater money. He had a desire to build buildings. He had a desire to own certain beautiful structures in, that were beautiful in his mind. That he has a, does he have a desire to own the whole capacity of New York City? No, he only has a desire to own Trump Towers. Alexander the Great, if he were in this generation, he would have a desire to control and own all of New York City, using that as an example of one generation to the other. I hope it's a good example and makes it clear to you.
So the next generation, we expect to have less desire than the current one?
We would have expected to have less desire than the current one. Just put it in terms of your own self, and I don't mean to embarrass you with this, but let's talk about, you know, you're a millennial, right?
I was born in 68.
Okay. So I can't say you're a millennial, but I think let's put it in terms of the desire to have children seems to be less in this nation in the millennials. They don't seem to have a desire to have children. They want to have it's really the Gen X is more like they don't really want to have children. They want to have fun. They want to have pleasures. You know, they're attracted to the physical pleasures. But from a desire to have children, two generations earlier, which would be my parents, you know, they wouldn't even think, you know, it was inconceivable that they would not have a child. Everyone knew they needed to have children. It was a need, it was a desire, it was something strong and innate within them. But that's not true in the younger generation. You would expect every generation to be less of a desire to receive, a less of a capacity. Why? Because it's dirtier. It's brought more crap into its this lifetime from its previous lifetime. It's been building on itself, lifetime after lifetime. Ultimately, the soul that comes into this world as a newborn baby today was in the desert when Moses existed. It has the ultimate capacity. It has the capacity to reveal the full light of the Ein Sof, which is what was represented by Mount Sinai. It's the same soul, but it's not the same capacity because that soul has filtered itself. It's rolled in the mud and the dirt. Is it clear?
it probably leads to more questions.
That's all right. If you have them right now, if not, we can do it next week.
Yeah, I'll have to formulate those.
Not a problem. Hana Esther, do you want to ask the question or do you want me to?
I'm sorry, I had to unmute. My question is about, I guess, dates. I was reading about the Tzadikim, and for example, on the 14th, and I noticed, I think, that it was Vav Yud, I'm not sure, but the question it brought up to me, that was 14, which was 6 plus 9, and why would that be used? Or maybe it was Dalid Yud, which is also, it used one of them and not the other. And that was my question. When we're doing like dates and numbers, why would we use one combination rather than another combination of letters?
Well, the easiest way to look at a number is the gematria of the letter itself. And the letter 10, the yud, is a complete structure. The number aleph is also a complete structure. 1, 10, 100, 1,000, those are complete structures. So you use the yud first when you're counting from 10 to 20, and then you use the kaf when you're counting from 20 to 29. And so forth. So one of the questions or corollaries you asked about was, why would you choose, in the case of the number 14, the word is Dalid Yud? Or is it Yud Dalid? The Yud is 10, the Dalid is 4. Both ways, it adds up to 14. So why do we use the yud first? The answer is, every date in the month has its own essence. But sometimes there's more than one essence. Usually there's always more than one essence. So in the case of 14, which is the gematria of the word of the name David, Dalid Vav Dalid, 14 represents 7 twice. 14 represents Malchut. That's what's hinted at by the name David. Now let's look at the number itself. Yud Dalid spells the word hand, Yad. And as a hand, what do you do with your hand is you make things, you manifest things. So that's the essence of the number 14. Can it be spelled Zion, Zion, 7-7? Yes, it can. But we count as a general sense, as I said, you count from 0 to, or you count from 1 to 10, in the order of the alphabet, and then you count from 10 to 100 in the continuing the order of the alphabet. So how do you make 17? Yud Zion. And it's in that order because you start with the Yud. How do you make 27? Kaf Zion. Now, let's go back to the number 14. What if I had spelled it Yud Dalit? Yud Dalit. Excuse me, that's the way I did spell it. What would it be if I spelled it Dalit Yud? It's the word Dai, as in the song Dai Dayenu. Enough, sufficient. Why is 14 sufficient? Because it represents Malchut, it represents manifestation. It represents manifestation of the direct light and manifestation of the returning light. And what else is there beyond that? That's sufficient. So every day of the month has an energy associated with the number value of that day. How do you know what that is? You learn Hebrew, you ask questions, and you get to understand it. Now, your question is, why did we do it Tet Vav, which is 15? Why don't we say Yud He? Because Yud He is the upper worlds in the Tetragrammaton. And so some people, the religious people, will tell you honor and awareness, and not to abuse the energy, we would not say Yud He, but we change the numbers, change the letters back to Tet Vav. But Tet Vav is 15. Tet Vav spells the word two. And the word two is Tu Ba'av. It's a holiday of love. So you can see where the connections are. You have to look at the letters, look at what they mean. What does a Tet mean? Well, Tet doesn't necessarily spell a word. But if we change that to a Yud, the Yud is a hand, a Yad. When it's spelled out, it's got the same letters as hand. If we go back to the Aleph, what is the meaning of the letter Aleph? It's unity because of the number one. But it's also, there's a word in Hebrew called aluf, which means leader. Lieutenant, general, it represents the leader of something. What does the word bet mean? It means a house. What's the word gimel mean? It means a camel. What's the word dalet? It means a doorway. And so forth, as we go through each letter, the name of the letter. So this is what you learn in Gematria. And the relationships between the letter name and the letter number and the whole process of Gematria, that's what makes it such a spice of Torah. In the Perkei Avot, it says that the Gematria and the astrology are the spice of Torah. If you try and eat food without spices, it's very bland, and you don't really want to go back for more. But as you learn Gematria, as you learn the Hebrew astrology, it excites you. It's the taste is back to the Torah. I know it's a metaphor, but something to think about.
Thank you, Hanoch.
Are there any other questions?
Hanoch, I have a question about our Rosh Chodesh connection.
Okay.
I noticed that the first of Kislev will be a Thursday,
right.
December 1st.
Right.
Will we have it? Will it be that evening or the evening prior?
The evening prior. It will be Wednesday, the 31st. Excuse me, the 30th.
Okay, I will definitely be in attendance.
Be careful when you make statements like that by adding a phrase like "bli neder" or "without a vowel."
Right.
And I should have said
my schedule is clear.
That's something that I could read into the statement. But just to give you a metaphorical story, it's not such a metaphor. There was one of my teachers is Rabbi Berg from the Kabbalah Center, and his teacher was Rabbi Brandwein. And he was in Israel over Passover, and you know, they had just finished the Passover holiday, the seventh day. And one of these other students said, "I'm really sorry, Rav, that I missed the Seder with you, and I make sure that I will be at the Seder with you next year." Well, Rabbi Brandwein passed away before that next Seder. And so did the man. So he made a vow and he fulfilled the vow. It's just not the way he was thinking. So remember, when you make a statement that I will be in a certain place at a certain time, you're making a vow. Even if you don't use God's name in the vow, even if you don't mean it as a vow, the universe describes it as a vow. So if you say Bli Neder without a vow, if you say Bezrat Hashem with Hashem's help, or you modify it in some way, hopefully, then it's not a vow. But if you make a harsh statement, strong statement, I will be there. Do you know what's going to happen? Do you see the whole picture? The answer is no. So be careful.
I'll take your advice. That sounds very reasonable.
Any other questions? Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Have a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Shalom.